Georgetown, Delaware, and I'm speaking on behalf of the appellant. There are essentially two things that the appellant is asking of the court today. The first is a determination that in order to convict someone for terroristic threatening, it's required that to prove that the speaker of the threat should have reasonably foreseen that his words would be considered a serious expression of intent to commit bodily harm. And in this particular case, then, should Jason have reasonably foreseen that his words, I will kill you, would be considered a serious expression of harm to Mr. Edwards. The second thing we ask of you is that for a conviction of a hate crime, that it is required to prove that the person made a conscious decision to seek out the victim because of their race, sexual orientation, and so on. And in that matter, and in this case, I believe, ladies and gentlemen, that Mr. Edwards' role as a disciplinarian was the selecting factor and not his race. All of the cases, both the Supreme Court cases and the circuit decisions that have addressed the area of a specific threat, have emphasized that they must be looked at in context. And I think this is borne out by contrasting two of the cases cited, those being Watts v. U.S. and U.S. v. Cosmo, the Third Circuit case. Both of those cases ostensibly look like, on their face, political hyperbole, Watts being a threat to the president during the Vietnam War and the statements made at a peace rally. And they were indeed determined to be political hyperbole. Whereas Cosmo, likewise threatening letters to President Reagan and Marlon Fitzwater at the time, might on their face appear to have been political hyperbole, yet the court determined that in fact they were true threats. And I wish to emphasize then that this case of Jason Austin must be looked at in its context. Jason was a troubled youth, undisputed, from the age of 6, diagnosed almost immediately with attention deficit disorder. And as the court knows, impulse control disorder. And as the court knows, the development of impulse control in adolescence is often a long and troubled period of time. And particularly as indicated in the Roper versus Simmons death penalty case on juveniles, well documented that juveniles do have a difficult time with that area. And that's all juveniles, ladies and gentlemen, and Jason in particular, even unlike other adolescents that have problems with impulse control, was diagnosed with that particular problem. And that's why he ended up in the COPS program to begin with. It is a program that is specifically for youths such as himself that have difficulty controlling their behavior. From the age of 6 on, he used offensive words. He used threatening words. He called his mother many of the same things that he called the purported victim in this particular case. His teacher, Mrs. Wheeler, he called her those things. His former teachers at Cape Henlopen School District, he used those words with them. But all of them were in that context of a disciplinarian speaking to Jason. Even the victim in this case noted that Jason had been, he had observed Jason outside in the community in Milton on many occasions, and he had never seen him use this type of language and behavior. And indeed, the state has argued at times that that Jason, in these circumstances, had a choice of whether to lash out at Mrs. Wheeler, a white teacher that was in the area, or Mr. Edwards, who was the black disciplinarian. But I would suggest that the facts indicate that Mrs. Wheeler was not there in a disciplinarian capacity. She was outside of the room taking notes on what transpired on this occasion. When Mrs. Wheeler had been a disciplinarian, he had called her a crack whore. He had used the N-word with her. All of the things that he ended up exhibiting toward Mr. Edwards, he had exhibited previously to Mrs. Wheeler, but when she was in a disciplinarian capacity, and likewise with his mother.
Let me interrupt,
yes.
Because I think we all know that your client has a troubled background. A lot of people incarcerated in Smyrna also have troubled backgrounds and impulse control disorder and other mental and emotional problems that had something to do with their ultimately committing violent crimes.
Yes.
Your client threatened to commit a violent crime, and that threat was perceived by the person that it was aimed at as being a real threat. So why should we, or why should the law, be concerned about what was in your client's mind, which is what you're saying the standard should be, is whether your client should have foreseen that a threat to kill somebody would actually be viewed as a threat to kill somebody?
Your Honor, I think there are two problems. What you're suggesting might be that the standard might be a reasonable listener standard, basically. That so long as the listener took that as a true threat, then that is sufficient for the commission of the crime. Two things that are problems with that, one being that it doesn't take into consideration the particularly nervous, sensitive listener, that saying one thing to this gentleman might be perceived by him as a threat, and if I say the same thing to this gentleman, it is not perceived as a threat.
I'm not sure I'm following you.
Well, you're saying that so long as this listener, Mr. Edwards, perceived it as a threat, that that's sufficient.
Oh, and you're saying that you would agree that it would be sufficient if a reasonable person perceived it as a threat?
If the reasonable person speaker perceived, should have known that that would be perceived as a threat, then I think that the crime can be committed.
Let me jump in here just a minute, because I think Justice Berger's question really kicked off what was going through my mind as you were giving us the context. And I understand, Mr. Johnson, why you're giving us the context, because it relates to both of the issues to a large degree. But it seems to me that what's set up here is three possible alternatives. We look at the comment from the perspective of what, as you described it, what the speaker had reason to believe about his comments and whether or not they constituted a threat from his perspective. Second alternative is whether the recipient or receiver of those comments would have, under the circumstances, rationally believed them to be a threat. And then the third is, what would an objective person looking at the comments, given the context, believe in terms of whether those comments genuinely constituted a threat? But what I haven't heard about yet is, what relationship does this have to the constitutional argument that you've made in your brief about, as a matter of federal constitutional doctrine, what is a true threat? The state seems to argue that it's only if it's in a political context, although it cites at least one case where one can argue that it applied where there wasn't a political context. So can you define for us exactly what you'd like us to say is the way in which, as a matter of law, we should interpret the comments, from which perspective? And secondly, what is the constitutional doctrinal overlay, if any, that applies?
Your Honor, if I understand the question correctly, the state, I know, is proposing that political hyperbole case, because of Watts, that political hyperbole was the question. But in fact, all of the cases, Cosmo, again, was ostensibly political hyperbole, letters of threatening letters to the president, but the court literally defined true threat, that it had to be a true threat and not political hyperbole. And I think the language that I particularly favor is from the Planned Parenthood case. And again, this was a threat to abortion clinic operators. It didn't lend itself at all to an interpretation of political hyperbole. But Planned Parenthood said that a true threat, basically, is a statement in which, in the entire context and under all the circumstances, a reasonable person would foresee would be interpreted by those to whom the statement is communicated as a serious expression of intent to inflict bodily harm upon that person.
Now, that sounds to me like a third alternative, what a reasonable person, with hindsight, substituting their judgment for what was the context at the time, would interpret the comment to be, not from what you first advocated, which was that we should look at it from the perspective of what the speaker had reason to believe about his comments and the extent to which they would constitute a threat. Which are you advocating?
Your Honor, I understand that, and I think that the standard is an objective standard, but an objective standard looking at the reasonable speaker.
Well, what do we do with the facts of this case, Mr. Johnson, where the teacher, as I understand the record, said, it's true, I've heard this before from the same individual. However, this time, I thought he really meant it. And the teacher is a person who, according to the record, specializes in anger management, is used to abusive conduct, abusive language, and yet the record says the teacher this time thought the student meant it.
The teacher did say that and did testify accordingly, Your Honor. And that's why I'm placing the emphasis that I am on the context, because that was not a teacher, it was a disciplinarian, but that disciplinarian was specifically trained in dealing with those things physically. And there was no attempt to restrain Jason. There was no attempt to frisk him. And the context reflects that this was over in a matter of a few minutes. He continued on that day, went home. 18 days later, he had continued to go to school, and that's when he was charged.
Well, I know in your brief you seem to focus on the temporal aspect of the reaction, but yet, if the teacher's testimony is the teacher the disciplinarian believed the student would act on it, and clearly the person didn't have a gun in their possession that day, and the teacher's thinking, the disciplinarian's thinking, you know, I really think the student meant it, and I'm really concerned that one day he is going to come to school and act on what he said he would do. If you're harboring those continued concerns, why doesn't it make sense that you'd finally say, okay, well, I'm going to go to the police because it's still haunting me that I think he's going to act on what he said?
Your Honor, that might be, and I don't know from a factual basis what was going through Mr. Edwards' mind subsequent to that day. All I know is that no action was taken that day and for a period of time. But I think I'm getting away from my point that from an objective viewpoint, was it reasonable for Jason to expect that to be the reaction? And
well, wait a second. What difference does it make what he expects? I thought the standard is whether a reasonable person would foresee that their statement would be viewed as a threat.
I think we're saying the same thing, Your Honor.
You're saying that your client's a reasonable person?
I think that we're saying that would a reasonable person, and we have to assume that all of us are in that capacity.
Your whole argument is based upon the fact that your client's not a reasonable person. Your client is a disturbed person. Therefore, whenever he says things that a reasonable person said that, everybody would be scared because your client is a disturbed person and spouts all kinds of things, that's not a reason to be concerned.
I think that the law has to assume all of us are reasonable all the time, but that we look at this particular child and say, was it reasonable for him under the circumstances as a reasonable person to have expected that his behavior that was undisputed would have caused this reaction in Mr. Edwards?
Well, let's call it a hypothetical. If you tell a disciplinarian multiple times over a series of days, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to blow your brains out, we're going to hang you from a tree, and you keep threatening the person's life over a series of days, but then we come to the last day, and you say, looking the person straight in the eye, in my hypothetical, and I want you to know I really mean it this time. Would that be?
Yes, I think it could, Your Honor.
Well, the difference from my hypothetical in this case is that's the way the disciplinarian perceived it, isn't it?
We don't know that necessarily, I don't think. And I think that the language and the behavior of Jason on this particular occasion was no different than his language and behavior on previous occasions.
Well, if we're going to look at this as a matter of law and follow your line of reasoning, it seems to me, Mr. Johnson, that we have to fit it into some mens rea for terroristic threatening. And it seems to me there are only three options: that he intentionally made the comments with the idea of putting the person in the disciplinarian in fear, or he knowingly made the comments, knowing that those are the kind of comments which would put that person in fear, or he recklessly did so with a conscious disregard for the probability under the circumstances that a person would be put in fear by those comments. If we fail to put it under one of those three mens rea, which I think the penal code causes us to do, then we're inviting ad hoc, chaotic results for all the cases that follow. So with those mens rea in mind, how does the mens rea, as applied to the speaker on this occasion, give us guidance on how to resolve this case?
Excuse me. Your Honor, I believe I understand that and I believe to a great extent we're saying the same thing. I don't think that it was the I think the laws we have it now simply need parameters, and that the laws that exist now, leaves itself open to a lot of wild interpretations. If I may use as an example, for instance, if we adopted a reasonable listener standard and we said whatever the statement is by the speaker, and it doesn't matter whether it was intentional or reckless or negligent on his part, should a reasonable speaker have taken that as a threat? And then the danger of that would be two things. One, what about the unusually sensitive listener? And number two, and this doesn't come into play in this particular case, but does there have to even be a listener?
Well, we're about to get into your rebuttal time, and if you wanted to save your time, now's the time to tell me.
So
I'm about to ask you another question, but I'm not going to ask it if you want to save the balance of your time.
Go ahead and ask the question, Your Honor.
The law seems to be that in the absence of a stated mens rea in the statute, and terroristic threatening has none, there are only three options. You look at the actions of the accused from the point of view of whether the accused acted intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. Doesn't that say, as a matter of law, that the focus cannot be on the listener? It has to be on the mens rea of the actor.
Yes.
And of the three, what is your suggested result for us in this case? Which is the three that should apply? Which of the three should apply?
Your Honor, I suppose that my reaction would have to be an intentional crime. If we are to gather my arguments of looking at the circumstances and looking at the whether it's an objective standard, then it would have to be an intentional act.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. James Wakely on behalf of the State of Delaware. The context here is obviously significant. This was a program for disturbed youth, for problem students, for potentially violent individuals. What happened this day was this student became aggressive, became agitated with apparently no impetus. He was brought in that morning, sat down at his desk like all the other students, told to boot up his computer and get his daily assignments, at which point he refused, and then proceeded to become more and more agitated as he was told, can you just get your assignment and begin work? The teacher told him, Diane Wheeler told him, if you do not do your work, I'll have to give you a 2-minute violation. He again refused, became more and more agitated. And at that point, Ms. Wheeler told Mr. Edwards to remove Mr. Austin from the classroom, and he did. When they got in the next room, Mr. Austin got more aggressive, got more assertive with his comments. He told Mr. Edwards, I have cousins in the KKK. I have a godfather in the mob. He'll come. They'll string you up from a tree. And then he also said, I'll blow your brains out.
Was this all the same day, or didn't some of this occur in May and then the latter recur in June?
He had apparently on a number of occasions said, I have cousins in the KKK. I have a godfather in the mob.
Did he say it this day?
Yes.
That's your recollection.
That is my recollection from the record, Your Honor. And I believe at B9 in the state's appendix, it reflects that he did indeed say that I have cousins in the KKK on this particular date. To consider these words anything other than the very definition of a terroristic threat under the statute stretches the meaning of the statute to virtually nothing. In fact, even accepting the idea that there may be some inherent truth threat doctrine at play here, Mr. Austin himself said that the intent of his words was to back Mr. Edwards off, to place him in apprehension, to do precisely what the statute is intended to prevent. This clearly was a circumstance fitting the bill for true threat. And if you look at
I thought the statute was designed to prohibit threats that constituted substantial risk of harm or death.
Certainly, Your Honor.
I didn't think that the statute was designed to back people off.
Well, presumably, if you threaten the action, it is to get an effect out of it. It's either to cause the person to be in fear.
Well, the language is threatening. I think perhaps everyone can agree on that. The point, though, is, isn't it, what mens rea applies to the individual on this occasion for the purposes of determining whether the state satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt an essential element of the offense, and that's the implied mens rea.
Yes. And the state would argue that Delaware statute controls here, and 11 Delaware Code Section 251B says that the mens rea necessary is that he intentionally made the statement. The statement being, I'm going to blow your brains out. Now, if you read into it this, any sort of reasonable person, reasonable listener, reasonable speaker, the obvious intent was to place Mr. Edwards in fear.
So you think the highest mens rea applies. That's intentionally, not knowingly and not recklessly.
I believe it's intentionally made the statement. I do not believe that there need be an intent to place the person in fear. but that Delaware statute states that it that the mens rea required is the intent to make the statement, not that there is a subsequent intent on the effect the statement may have.
Nor is there a requirement for intent to carry out the threat.
Certainly not, Your Honor.
So that would mean you're guilty unless your defense was the statement was made involuntarily.
Assuming that, and this is stemming from the Kentucky cases, which is the only jurisdiction that the state could find that had a similar statute to Delaware's, that the statement was not made in jest, in which case it would not be threatening. Threatened to commit a crime would certainly not be a statement made in jest. The Kentucky line of cases is similar to the line of cases in Delaware in that their statute has no corollary in that they do not require that the person be placed in apprehension for their safety, which is also in the Model Penal Code. Obviously, the Delaware legislature intended to remove this portion of the statute and leave it such that mere words are sufficient to establish the crime of terroristic threatening.
Right, so there's some common ground, at least then, from the perspective that we don't need to focus on how the statement was received.
Certainly not, Your Honor. That would be the state's contention. What my learned colleague seems to argue is that Mr. Edwards either lied or misspoke when he said he was placed in fear based on his subsequent conduct. Well, he obviously wasn't in fear because he didn't call the police. He obviously wasn't in fear because he didn't.
Well, didn't we just establish it doesn't matter?
Yes, Your Honor. And the state would argue that that's certainly the case. Now, as to the issue of the hate crime, the state would argue that Mr. Austin had a choice here. He was disciplined by Ms. Wheeler. Ms. Wheeler was present for at least some portion of the argument between Mr. Edwards and Mr. Austin. Mr. Edwards testified that Ms. Wheeler was in the doorway of the classroom during at least some portion of the exchange. The family court below found that as well. And the state would argue that at least two occasions he made the choice of who to make the threatening statements to. The state would also argue that there wasn't much testimony, if any, to the effect that Mr. Austin had threatened Ms. Wheeler in any substantial amount. The statements may have been, "You're a crack whore," even if the state concedes that, that is not in and of itself threatening. Maybe extremely offensive, but it doesn't meet the definition of the terroristic threat. The fact is that the conduct of Mr. Austin towards Mr. Edwards had been racial in tone for at least several months preceding this. There were a number of occasions where I have cousins in the KKK, they're going to string you from a tree. This is certainly a racially tinged threat. And when it came to this point, he again reiterated, "I have cousins in the KKK, they're going to string you from a tree, and I'm going to blow your brains out." The fact is that you can discern the intent of Mr. Austin to commit this hate crime by the difference in the level of vitriol directed at each of the two parties. Who was most responsible for disciplining Mr. Austin? It was Ms. Wheeler. She was the one that instructed him to do his assignment. She was the one who instructed Mr. Edwards to remove him from the classroom. And she was the one on a day-to-day basis who was most in charge of controlling Mr. Austin's behavior. Mr. Edwards was, for lack of a better term, little more than a security guard on this occasion, keeping Mr. Austin separate from the rest of the classroom, as is apparently protocol within the career opportunity program. Mr. Austin had a choice. He had a choice to calm down, to continue making statements exactly like he made, "I hate this effing school, I hate this effing place, this is a waste of my effing time," but he chose not to do that. He chose instead to tell Mr. Edwards, I have a cousin in the KKK who's going to string you up from a tree, and I'm going to blow your brains out. Clearly, there was substantial evidence in the record to suggest that Mr. Austin intended to commit this crime upon Mr. Edwards on the basis of his race, and as the family court found in their substantially thorough opinion, Mr. Austin did indeed intend to inflict this crime upon Mr. Edwards, and this court should, in the state's opinion, affirm the judgment below. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, at the first argument in this matter, I made an analogy that I think remains appropriate, and that is the analogy of myself as a public defender, that at times I am placed in a room with a person that is not of my race or national origin, and that at times things are said to me that, if taken out of that context, would appear to be a terroristic threat and would appear to be a hate crime. But the person that is in that room with me is there fortuitously. They did not select me to represent them. I did not select them to be represented by me. It is happenstance that we are placed together, and it is happenstance that one of us is perhaps white and one is perhaps black. And I see no difference between that and Justin Austin's circumstances, where on this particular occasion, this disciplinarian happened to be black, and Jason struck out at him the only way he knew how, verbally and abusively, but it was because he was a disciplinarian. And I think the record is full of examples where that is what Jason did with disciplinarians.
Let me stop you for a second.
I'm sorry?
Let's assume that the disciplinarian was a white man.
Yes.
Based upon this record, we can all assume that your client would have lashed out at him, would have said all kinds of horrible things just because he's a disciplinarian, right?
Yes.
But the disciplinarian happened to be an African-American, and your client made use of that in the way he lashed out at the disciplinarian, right?
Yes.
Isn't that enough for it to be a hate crime?
I don't think that he made a, because I'm asking for an interpretation, that he seek the person out because of their race, and not that he just happens to end up in a room with him. In previous occasions, he had a white teacher, for instance, at Cape Henlopen, and he sought that person's, what he perceived as that person's weakest link, and knew that they had recently married a younger woman and therefore came up with the pedophile attack on that person. And likewise with Ms. Wheeler, she's a white woman, and he chose to call her a crack whore.
Now she's in the doorway at the time of these other.
She's taking notes, Your Honor. Yes.
So, why do we have to accept that the focus is on the disciplinarian from the evidence, as opposed to the African American in the room?
Well, if the white teacher would have been in the room, I believe probably she would, and disciplining him, Jason, I believe she would have been the subject of his language at that point. Also, in addition to Mr. Edwards. But she wasn't. She wasn't threatening him. I'm sorry.
On this issue, one of the difficulties I'm having is the trial judge, as the state points out, has made extensive findings. And isn't the standard of review on this issue, even if we accept your interpretation of what selects mean, isn't the standard of review insufficiency of the evidence? And how do we reach a conclusion that the trial judge got it wrong based on the facts he found about your client selecting the disciplinarian and the language he used based upon the disciplinarian's race?
No, I think the only result could be for a redetermination by the trial judge as using the standard that we have suggested on, as to hate crime, if I've answered that, your question.
Well, you don't believe the trial judge approached it from that perspective?
No, I don't believe that the trial judge looked at the standard that I'm suggesting, that he made a conscious, that Jason made a conscious decision to seek out the person because of their race.
Well, let me quote you from the judge's decision. The defendant had an obvious disrespect and extreme dislike for Edwards because he is African-American and selected Edwards as a victim because of his race. Doesn't that satisfy the test if it's supported by the record?
No, I don't think it does, Your Honor. I understand, I recall the quote from the judge, but that's his conclusion. That's not his analysis. He concluded, obviously, that Jason sought him out because of his race. But at the there was no analysis on the part of the judge as to whether there had been some conscious decision on the part of Jason to seek out the person. I don't think that the trial judge would have disagreed that their placement in that room together was fortuitous, was happenstance. But he didn't analyze whether there was, in fact, a seeking out of the person because of their race.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Sure.